And tonight we have another great show dealing with metaphysics and spirituality and science and physics itself, as well as some other related topics, especially consciousness. Tonight will be part of what we're going to be talking about. I thought it would be good to go over the individual and group nature of human souls tonight. Now, a lot of people say, well, what does that mean? How could you be both anyway? And on and on. So we're going to be talking about that, and I hope that this will clear up some people's confusion about souls in general. But human souls have a much more complex nature than the souls of other creatures. And we are unique. We're closer, much closer to our Creator because of it. And we're much more creative as well. So let me define what I mean by individual and group nature so that we're clear about that. A human soul is unlike a soul of, a dog or a cat or a spider or a flower, is focused on and unique in its consciousness to connection with a single life form being us, a human. We are the, we'll call it, the pilgrim coming from our soul to enter into dimensions of time and space and to live there with sense and consciousness that the human soul cannot do itself, because if it did, it would, like us, become illusioned, selfish, and unable to operate in a soul-like way most of the time. Therefore, to avoid that severe consequence, human souls help to create human beings. And they endow us with the nature to become our soul if we choose to function and live that way while we're separated from our soul in these lower dimensions of time and space that we live in. So that being the case, what is it so special that is so special about a human soul that makes it into truly a unique being in its own right? And that is that its consciousness, like all other kinds of souls, is such that its sense or its form nature, its senses, are equal to its consciousness, which is a good thing. In other words, there's a balance between what it can sense and how conscious it is. And that's a very good quality, by the way. It's not perfection, but it is at least a kind of, call it, balanced state. And beyond just being balanced, the human soul has a unique nature to it in that its consciousness is highly focused on the second part of spirit or God's thought. And that thought, in this particular case, then, is about love and inclusiveness, planning, consciousness in general. And that makes the human soul a very special kind of being because it's located literally in the mental part of time and space, in the mental dimension. It's located in a position in which it is dominated by what are called the even rate energies, especially the second and the fourth, but somewhat the sixth as well. So all the even rate energies dominate the human soul. However, this is an interesting point. That's in terms of its consciousness. Its awareness is focused much more. Now, awareness is different than consciousness, as you all know, but I'll define that too. Awareness is the input of information. In other words, when we are informed through some sense, that's awareness. Different than consciousness. So consciousness is the ability to take the information, create knowledge from it, and then use the knowledge in ways that expands the knowledge. That's called consciousness. So consciousness is like another step away from awareness, and it involves first the synthesization of knowledge from awareness. And the interesting thing about this is that souls are much more focused in awareness along the first, third, fifth, and seventh parts of energy. So there's an emphasis in souls along those types of awareness. And the consciousness side of the soul is focused more on the second, fourth, and sixth types of energies. And you can say, well, what does that do? Does it make the soul kind of schizoid or something? You know, not really. It adds something to the soul that, and to the human soul, that is especially helpful. And that is that when the human soul is dealing with ways of loving and ways of acting together with other souls or anything else, if it's acting together with them, it is much better in dealing with things that are affected by those ray line of energies, the second, the fourth, and the sixth. And yet when it is functioning along the first, third, fifth, and seventh ray lines of energy, in other words, where it's trying to help to develop something along the focus of those ray energies, and when it's using its senses, it's much more along the first part of God's thought, of spirit, and of God's mind as well. And it has, by nature, therefore, an individuality. The first part of it comes from its awareness, and that leads to its own individuality. And the second part comes from its desire and seeking to be inclusive and one with others and to work with others together along ray lines of focus that are second, fourth, and sixth, and that produces a group consciousness to the soul. So that's where those two kinds of consciousness come from, and they build a nature to the soul that is really unique in itself, because the two come together, and the soul is able to balance these two. And when it does, it is able to find a very important virtue, and that virtue is called truth. So it's the ability to understand these two different aspects to one's existence, and I'm using us in terms of ourselves now, because we can function as souls if we choose to. And if we are able to do so, the unique aspect of this, which is kind of fascinating, is that, first of all, we become very versatile and highly creative, because we're now functioning along all seven ray lines, four of them, the first four, but the four that are more masculine or odd-numbered, affect our awareness in greater amounts. And the remaining feminine ones that are even, some people call them even numbered, affect our consciousness more. And by trying to balance our consciousness to our awareness, we can derive the virtue of truth. Okay? Now, most people say, when I talk to them, how do I know what truth is? Well, I can explain it to them the way I just explained it to all of you out there. But if they aren't familiar with some of the vernacular and prior programs and other things, or writings that I've done, or writings of many, many other authors about principles of agents' wisdom in general, that topic being sometimes covered by other names, but it doesn't matter. The concept is the same. And so if they're not familiar with that, then they wouldn't be able to understand what I just explained. So that's how we as human beings are able to determine truth. Now, can animals do this? To a very, very limited amount. More so if they have contact with us, with human beings. Our pets, if they're advanced types of pets, dogs and cats and some other animals, a horse might, but they can develop some level of understanding truth. Lower forms of animals, it escapes their ability to do so because, first of all, their consciousness is seldom high enough. And so they usually have an imbalance in the consciousness side. Remember, our souls are located with the advantage towards the consciousness in terms of where they're placed in the mental world on the fourth subplane of the second subplane. You can hear the second and fourth being near its feminine qualities, right? And that's where the soul is trapped. The human soul, so to speak, is trapped there because you really can't exist any place other than that one little location. It can sense from other parts of the mental world, but it has to have the assistance of energies and other things. But the point is that this gives us an advantage, in a sense, because it really focuses on the development of consciousness in comparison to the development of awareness. So much so that awareness has one quarter more, or actually, depending on how you look at it, it has more overall weight to the sense side because there's four rays of masculine attribute in comparison to the three of feminine. And so despite that, there's an equality because the soul is so literally focused on the consciousness side. We could call it a more feminine being, in a sense. But that isn't exactly true because there's some balance between the two by the fact that there's more awareness from the number of ray focuses, even though the two are exactly balanced in technical terms, but they're balanced from things that aren't just related to how many rays are being focused through the being at that time. So this is a relatively complicated subject, but it explains so much in terms of the question of how the nature of a human soul has both individual and group nature. Most people get confused by many books that describe the soul as a, by nature, group-conscious being. Well, that's true. By nature, it is a group-conscious being. But also by nature, it's an individual being. And so are we. This confuses us to no end. And it is probably the reason that we have so much dissension and problems in the physical world, while we're physically alive, because we really can't find truth very easily. And you need to find truth to understand these differences between individual and group nature without falling prey to darkness and evil. And that is so much true as an example in the physical world when we deal with such subjects as communism. A lot of people say, well, communism makes kind of a sense. It's a group conscious thing. It assumes that we can all live as group conscious beings and we can share everything. And we don't have to have an individual nature. Well, you know, that's kind of interesting. I mean, as some kind of maybe utopian thought process. But it has little or has nothing to do with who human beings really are. We are individual and group in nature. And if the individual side is not developed or ignored, as it happens in communism, then the results can be disastrous. Let me give you a further example of this. Since the individual nature of us comes from the mostly masculine side of the race, or the odd side, 1, 3, 5, 7, what do those rays really pertain to? Well, they pertain to areas of the following, which is going to probably surprise people when I explain this. They pertain to our political and nature and the way we govern ourselves. So we should govern ourselves then as individuals, more on the individual side than on the group side. And we should also, in terms of making policies, the policy should be to guard the rights of individuals and not be so concerned about the rights of groups. That doesn't mean you ignore the rights of groups. It just means that individuals come first. And that's exactly like what the founders of the United States came to the conclusion about. I find that fascinating. Now, a number of them, about at least a quarter, if not more, were true followers of ageless wisdom thought. So, maybe I shouldn't be so so amazed by what they came up with. Then we go to the third ray, and that deals with the elements of police militarism, large developments of society, and banking, large aspects of economies that also need to be dealt with on an individual rather than a group basis. Now, people might say, well, hold on. The military is the most group-like thing. You got all these people marching around, and everybody's got to follow the orders of, you know, some commander, et cetera, and blah, 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 blah. And it goes on and on and on. Right? Yeah, that is true in terms of some aspects of military existence. But if you look at the true level of military development in terms of success, it's founded upon the development of qualities of individual nature. In other words, a successful military is a military that believes in the profound development of the individual, not the ignoring of the individual with the profound development of the group. When you do go down that line, you almost invariably end up having a military that has little depth to it and is easily overcome by the valor and heroism of an opponent who follows the individual line of development. Now, that can be debated by a lot of people, and I have heard the debates on both sides. I will just tell you that taken to its extreme levels, the individual side will invariably win. And that's why you don't want a highly motivated enemy on an individual basis, because those are going to be very tough to deal with. Especially if they're radicalized like terrorists, et cetera, that becomes a real serious problem. Okay, let's move on to the question about like things like banking and elements of that. How does that apply to this kind of situation? Well, oddly, the control and use of money is best handled through what is known as free market system and what we call the venturing or the use of monies in a form in which it is capital, used as capital, and we call that whole thing together, free market, etc., capitalism. Now, why is that good? Because it fits the model of an odd rate system that is good. Communism is the opposite, and it's very poor in developing an economic system of success because nobody is rewarded on an individual basis for participating in the system. It's based somewhat on need and mostly on the prejudice of central planning. So it is not it's not anything like capitalism. It's the antithesis. And then when you get to the next of the we'll call masculine or odd rays, the fifth ray applies so strongly to the individual because it's the ray that finds truth. We sometimes refer to it as science or the seeking of epistemology or knowledge. I mean, these sorts of things all fall under the fifth ray. There's a lot of other things. Law also. And when we examine this, it's pretty obvious that it also deals with the individual when it is most successful. Now, does that mean a group of scientists or lawyers could not function successfully? No, they do, but they usually do by having individual input into the total conclusions of the group. The group can work and be a success, but usually each individual is providing unique ideas and thought and we'll even say physical work. That's the more common successful approach. Could you, as an example, have a truly group approach? You could, but those models have shown that they don't succeed. that's the problem. And again, the reason for it is you go against the nature of the human soul, and then you go against the nature of the human being when you do that. And finally, along the seventh right, which is really deals with mostly things of where human endeavor is a direct response to the earning of a livelihood. It could be anything from farming to being in business, to small businesses especially, to some areas of just organizing various things for the sake of making it easier to and less expensive in time and energy to produce something. In all these situations, the individual becomes a unique being. I mean, a group of people that try to organize something, you ever seen that happen? It's called chaos. So the point is, you can't, it doesn't work, and that's why individual businesses are usually run by individuals. Now, you can have partners, you can have each one doing something separate. Even in group, spiritual groups, when it's involving the material side of things, individuals almost always have individual responsibilities, and they function as individuals. They can actually be responsible for a great deal of material issues on an individual basis. They're still part of a spiritual group, but it doesn't matter. That's how it needs to work to define and to control the issues of individuality. Now let's flip over. Let's flip to the other side. What about the group nature of people? Well, that is a totally interesting and the other side of the ballgame, because in terms of education, it's best, we learn best when we are educated in a group process. Now, why is that? Because the inflow of ideas and the expression of ideas is best experienced when they are in the immediate moment challenged by others and discussed and learned in that way. So, yes, you could be taught as an individual, but it's not as strong and as powerful as being taught within a group of people where the ideas are freely associated. It's a very interesting point. Most successful educational programs involve group learning. I mean, this is so fascinating. That's even true when you get to some of the most creative models. They still prefer having groups involved than purely individuals. Yeah, it's true. So, now, does that mean you can't learn as an individual? Lots of people have tutors, and some people have only had tutors. Can't they learn that way? Yes, but oftentimes their education becomes more narrow. Their thoughts and their thought processes, not being having been challenged by so many different minds, becomes sometimes less than rather than more than what it could be. That's the problem. And when you move to the fourth level, you know, this is where people really get confused. They think, well, art, isn't that the fourth ray is art, everything art. Art is very individual. People are just doing individual this and individual that. Well, you know, that's a kind of interesting thing. There is some individuality in art. Individuality is usually the expression of a person's single, we'll say, idea or thought expressed. But it's the medium that is the group issue. Very rarely, does the medium significantly, not a little bit, but significantly change from one artist to another. They may introduce some slight variances in their medium modality. Instead of using oil paints or acrylics, maybe they would choose to use some kind of new invention of paint or expression of color in a movement with a brush or some other device. But it still has within its context mostly a group kind of expression. So you find art along those group expressions. Rarely will somebody, as an example, make their own musical instrument. And even if they do, it usually follows the thought of many others of similar type. So to make a unique one is truly great, and there's nothing wrong with that, except if we're talking about art, that's not the way it usually goes. So art, again, follows a group nature to it, even though the individuals have their unique expressions within it. It still has this kind of group nature. So you have many people playing maybe an instrument like the violin or the trombone. They may all have slightly different trombones than the violin. They may play them slightly differently with certain kinds of emphases and expressions in different ways. But they're playing the same instrument. And in similar ways, if you really look at the foundation, so similar they can get together and play in great groups called orchestras and bands. You see, this is the interesting part about what we think about. And so now we have the second and the fourth. Now what about the sixth? Well, religion. Most religion is based upon groups. Yes, people have individual thoughts and feelings about their community. They may disagree with some of the tenets of certain elements of a religion that they choose to belong to. But if they are involved in a religion, the commonality rather than the specific individuality is what brings them together and holds them. So we can see that the group conscious elements are so profoundly, we'll say, prejudiced towards the group nature of humans. Whereas the individual aspect that deals instead with group consciousness but with awareness and the creation that comes from awareness, that is truly along the first, third, fifth, and seventh types of energies that express themselves in mostly individual ways. And this is why people get so confused, because humans do both. They do both. What happens if you confuse these? What happens if you take the first individual way of expression, and instead of following the founders of the United States' ideas, you say, well, what about Marx and Engels? They knew what the heck they were talking about. Let's go down that road. Yeah, well, when you start doing a collective process that involves 2, 4, and 6, with 6 actually replacing 1, the two of them are almost opposite. In other words, the state becomes like a religion, and people follow the state as they might in religion. That's communism, by the way. Also, most types of socialism fall into that. And so when you do that, what happens is this. You end up with removing the virtue that was originally contained in the light that the ray line would produce, and instead, you replace it with darkness. That's right. Because evil reverses things. And they don't try to be very creative. They just say, oh, let's just reverse it. And so they do. And the results can be pretty disastrous, to say the least. Let's say a third way. Let's say you want to, okay, I'm going to develop a military where no one person gets a standout of anything. We don't even give medals for anything. Everybody is just a machine, a cog in the wheel. And they're all going to go out and fight just the way we tell them to. They're going to die when they have to. They're going to live when they do. Everything is going to be, they eat the same exact way. And they do. All this is going to be, this is going to be the perfect military by some general standards. Okay? And actually there have been some military types who believe in this. What happens to those types of armies? Well, if history is any kind of judge of such a thing, they almost invariably come across a more virtuous but very individual fighting group who are more concerned about each individual's capabilities. And yes, they fight together, and they have very disciplined methods of doing so, but they're based upon learned and chosen actions, not becoming little robots. And they get whooped real bad, like 300 versus 75,000. That happened at a pass in Greece. Yeah, they get whipped real bad. Now, eventually they might win just by sheer numbers, but the point is that that's the sort of thing that happens. And why does it happen? What is the nature? What are we combining or confusing? Well, you're taking the third-rate nature of something And again, you're pressing onto it, in many respects, elements of the fourth and sixth ray, so that it's no longer expressing itself the way the third ray would normally do so. And it becomes very dark in the process. And this has been done numerous times with great failure. Now, interestingly, those armies, when they have overwhelming odds, almost always win. But not win in terms of losses. They may lose 10 times as many, but they just have large numbers. And it's easy to build armies of large numbers where everybody's kind of a robot because, you know, they're all averaged out. But if you get some superlative folks against them, they can lose huge numbers. But the superlative ones may lose very small numbers, and as long as they can keep it somewhat balanced, they might actually win the small number ones. Okay, so there's the third ray going off into odd angles. Now, what happens when the fifth ray goes off in odd angles? You get quote-unquote great think tanks where people just work. Each one is working as a little cog on a great big problem, but nobody really understands what the hell they're doing. Right? Okay. Ever seen that? I have. Okay, so then what happens? Well, what happens is they can't create anything really new. They can sometimes solve simple problems. But when faced with something that requires true genius or true, we'll say, creative ability, they fail. Tremendous amounts of time are wasted. Also, these folks tend to become more and more egotistical and arrogant and lose all concept of truth. Usually they work in universities or places like that where nobody has to stand out. Nobody has to really expect to do anything. They're pretty much technocrats than they are scientists. Those kinds of folks have their problems. Same thing happens if you have a big law firm where people work together as teams rather than as individuals. That happens with some kind of insurance carriers and companies. And usually they're very good about throwing out the garbage about, you know, stuff that is boilerplate things. But when they have to creatively figure out some way to deal with a problem, forget it. And so that's the same thing that happens there. And, of course, they almost always don't work on the side of truth, which is not good. And finally, when you get to businesses that are run, we'll say, by large groups rather than by individuals. This can happen, strangely, with the inculcation of heavy-handed unions who pretty much run the business rather than the people who own the business. It can also happen in businesses where you have boards running things more than you have individuals reporting to a board. But in either case, the results can be disastrous. You end up with, it's almost like a school kind of thing instead of a business. And people don't really get to the point where they are entrepreneurial anymore. They're more concerned about maybe holding on to what they have and not losing so much here or there. There is a stagnation that stifles those companies, and usually they get beaten out by more creative, more entrepreneurial companies, often a tenth their size, and, with very little of a capital, but with a lot more ingenuity. Okay, so, and a lot more willingness to work in terms of time and energy. So when we look at how this, and I'm trying to show the practical side of all this, when we look at all this and we put it together, we start beginning to see how it is that the nature of a human soul and a human being, when they're trying to be their soul, is a critical element to the entire process of being here in the physical world, and later on, to a lesser extent, in the astral world, where these things become so, by nature, expanded upon and magnified. The soul doesn't worry too much about it in its realm, because there it's in an almost perfect balance with other souls. Where it becomes a problem is right where we are right now. The physical world, by nature, causes separation. And the separation between individual and the group consciousness of a human being has led to terrible, terrible things. Everything from drug addiction to crime to procrastination to literally the worst of what people would be considered to be sins in human existence. We're going to talk a lot more about that when we come back. So, at any rate, I hope I've kind of got your interest peaked in this seemingly very esoteric subject, and I'm trying to make it, even at the beginning of the show, which I don't do too much, into a more practical thing, because I knew that this was going to be, to carry it through the whole show would be way too much on the esoteric side, and not enough to really make it understandable. So when we come back, we're going to see some even more practical sides of this issue, and some other things you may not have thought about. We'll be back in about 2 minutes and 30 seconds or so from right now.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for a better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. McFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight we're talking about the individual and group nature of human souls. But we're also talking about this in ourselves as well, because we are sort of souls at a distance. And we can get closer to our soul if we function more virtuously while we live here in the physical world. But it is here that this individual and group nature that I'm talking about becomes almost a war in each of us, and sometimes between us. And that's a problem. So I wanted to bring this into a practical arena to talk about this problem as it can manifest throughout, well, so many different parts of our life here in the physical world, and even somewhat into the astral world if we have time. So let's talk about what, again, this problem is. On the individual side, our awareness tends to focus more on the elements of the first, third, fifth, and seventh types of expression of ourselves through those energies. And on the group nature side, we tend to exaggerate or think more on the second, fourth, and sixth sides of expression. These two can become embattlements for us. And let me talk about some of the areas of the most severe crisis. You'll recall in the beginning of the show, or towards the beginning, I talked about the fourth ray expression and how it confuses people. If for no other reason, then most people think of heart as an expression of individuality. Well, there certainly is that in every art I can think of, but at the same time, there is this group nature to art, which is so strongly inherent in the fact it's the form of the expression. So art is kind of like the flip side of this whole thing. And that's where you find some of the greatest conflicts on an individual or inside level of a human being. Human beings, by nature, want to express themselves because they have a personality which seeks to be an individual expressor. It doesn't want to be part of a group. It's true. And it finds itself most comfortable when it is an expression of individuality. However, it has another problem, and that is that it is afraid to be too independent because it fears the failure aspect. And when it fails, it sees that and is moving itself towards pain and misery and death. So it has an oversensitivity to failure. And as long as it is succeeding, it loves to revel in its own individuality. But even with the slightest hint of failure, it's running for the herd and wants to be part of the masses and group. So it is in this quandary that a person who is trying to express themselves on the fourth type of energy, where art is usually found to some extent, they may have a problem. And the problem usually goes something like this. They want to be an individual, but the medium through which they express themselves, they want to be accepted in by others within that field. If it's in the field specifically of art, and they happen to be a painter, then they don't want to just paint pictures that are completely different from everyone else. They want them to be seen by all, and especially all who have some appreciation of the form of the art, to be superlative or great, wonderful in some way, so that it brings beauty into the beholder of the art. Now, that doesn't mean conventional beauty. That's the more true definition of beauty, where it enlightens the sense of someone else to perceive the art of the artist. But this is a problem, because many artists, through their individuality in their expression, do not conform to the standards that a lot of people are conditioned to believe is beautiful, or that is sought, at least in terms of being purchased or wanting to be seen or heard or whatever, as a form. So the artist is continually in a conflict within themselves to express themselves as an individual while at the same time to be accepted in their medium as an artist. Now, they may have more than one medium. That probably would be helpful, by the way, because when they're not accepted sometimes in one medium, they might be accepted in another. So there are some, we'll call it, compensation. Those who have only one form that they express themselves through are more prone to be harmed by this particular conflict of system. And artists, therefore, have a temperament that may be exaggerated and may be even taunted by this individual and group nature that they're in conflict in themselves about. They want their work to be accepted, and yet they want to be an individual. And so that's where the problem lies. Now, it is true that an artist who finds a completely new means of expression that's unique to themselves may avoid some of this angst and And maybe they even do it for that purpose, who knows. But the point is that it is still not easy, because you're still working through some form, and that form may or may not be accepted, despite the fact that you are or not individually creative within it in a way which produces some level of beauty in the eye of the beholder. This is an interesting problem throughout all parts of the world and all societies. It becomes a greater problem when the society itself has an exaggeration of the group nature of it, or form nature, and where you battle harder to be accepted against a large established group. Places in first world countries, such as the United States, have this. And therefore, artists in those countries have peculiar tensions within themselves and problems that they have to face. They may not live as long because of this. By very nature, being along the fourth ray, especially when the fourth ray is not a focus, as it has been in the past few hundred years, coming back in now, but not fully yet, produces higher levels of tension and problems within the person, which for one reason or another, many different ones, but all related to the concept that I'm explaining, may lead to weaknesses that leads to early death and illness as well. So this is one of the areas where individuality and group nature provides an unfortunate barrier towards long life and sometimes adequate senses of accomplishment and success. Wow. Okay, that's just one of them. Let's cover something else. Well, let's look at the first way. Move away from the even and move towards the first way. First way involves politics, government, policy, inventiveness, pure inventiveness. Inventions can also be covered under certain elements of some of the other I've raised, so 10th, 3rd, and 5th, but lots of invention usually comes from the first. Also, people who are destroyers by profession, that can be part of it, and sometimes creators, like developers. But regardless, when you look at the process, you look at the whole thing, there is again, you have the individual versus the group nature. In all these situations, there can be a conflict between those two within the person. A politician, as an example, has to get elected and requires large groups of people helping to do that. The higher the office, and the larger the responsibilities, the greater usually the number of people that are helping to get that person elected and then to keep them in office and help them serve in office. And so when you look at all this, there's a tremendous group nature. But at the same time, the individual nature is in the primary target, oftentimes, of your opponents, and the aspect that when all is said and done, it's really up to that one individual as a politician or a policymaker to make oftentimes decisions. This leads to a kind of unusual nature in itself of being able to find, again, truth and to hold to a common structure of thought or truth, because on the one side, you may not be able to tell the truth and get elected. And on the other side, I'm just giving an example. I mean, this doesn't cover all the elements of the first right. And on the other side, you may be able to get elected, but then not institute individual creative policies that are truly helpful for the development of the society or the particular office in the area and field that you're in. So we can see this imbalance going back and forth, and it so happens so obviously. If we look at the United States, we elect, say, a congressman or a senator to an office. That person got there because they kept saying, oh, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, etc. And most of the time they get elected because of the things that they say. But when they get to the point where they have to vote on these things, they start counting up how many votes they make one way or the other to determine how they should vote, instead of voting with what is truth and right and just, and in accord possibly with what they promised when they ran. So we have consistently politicians that are untruthful and that are hypocritical and lack the gumption to be able to follow through on the statements of policy they made before they were elected, and they become averages or compromises of policies when they finally get to office. I mean, nobody's happy. So you can see that that leads to, on a personal scale, someone who's going to, over time, live the life of a hypocrite and find themselves continuously asking themselves who they really are and coming up short. It's a problem that is almost epidemic here in the United States and many other countries. How do you solve that? Well, part of this has to be functioning more as a soul. I mean, the problem of all these situations is that the person is acting selfishly with disregard for what is godly and right. And that's their problem. They're not soul-like. They're functioning mostly personally and not in a soul way. So we need politicians who are more soul-like, and I don't know where you find them. But when you do, the question then becomes, can we get them elected? Because a soul-like politician is not going to say what others want to hear. They're going to say the truth. And that's sometimes, in the political world, suicide. But maybe we can change. So not only do the politicians need to change, but the electorate has to choose to want to elect people who are more virtuous and who seek the light and seek to govern within the light. Wow, that's a pretty interesting thing, huh? Yeah. Okay, so what about the, let's come to the second one and talk about that. Well, the field, you know, this is an interesting point. People, when they are teachers or when they're students, are involved in a process that is, majority of it is dominated by group thought in comparison to individual awareness. And one of the problems that teachers have in this arena is that their unions, school boards, and others decide a good deal of the curriculum, the means of teaching, so many other aspects of the teaching arena that the teacher themselves might feel, and oftentimes this could be a problem, that they are not able to teach as effectively. So as a teacher, they can't express themselves, even though they understand they're part of a group process and they want to be. The group process can become exaggerated to the point where good teaching isn't taking place. If the union says, you got to keep all the bad teachers with all the good teachers, well, the good teachers are probably going to leave and the bad teachers are going to stay because they have job security, and the good teachers can't stand it because they can't stand children not learning to levels that they are capable of. And maybe they're not even rewarded for their own abilities in teaching. So that's a bad part of the problem. Then in addition, you have the group process to the extreme of too many students confined to one classroom or one teacher, or too many per teacher, whatever we get. Yeah, it's great to have a lot of minds functioning, but too many nullifies the ability for any one to be able to adequately express itself given the short time of a class. When that takes place, all of the advantages of using group process in teaching goes away. It just does. comparison, say, to Montessori method of teaching younger children, in that process, you involve yourself with creative elements where the other students are involved in them, but there's a balance. So you have the creation, you have the minds of others involved at the same time. It's one of the most creative teaching methods. But if you have 300 students, the Montessori system would fail, as any other major creative system, because the result would be the following. Each person, in expressing their thought, if you have 300 people and you have 60 minutes, each person has like 10 seconds. And that doesn't count the teacher talking or anything else. So when you look at it, it becomes an impossible model. It doesn't work because you have no expression, because there's little time for anybody to express themselves. And the process becomes either the teacher just lecturing. You've seen this happen, of course, if you've gone to large classrooms in colleges, especially in the lower grades in colleges, and the teacher just lectures. Why? Which isn't teaching by my counting about it anyway. And the process becomes one of a kind of monotonous problem. Now let's talk about me right here in this situation. I'm talking to all of you, and you're not involved in the process. This is really not the ideal situation. The ideal situation would be if we had a smaller group and we could have an exchange. That, right now, isn't the technological way that we have working for us. But it would be a better way. And the same is true in almost every other method, is that you want to have the opportunity for the minds that are present to be able to express themselves as much as possible. And our present system has many pitfalls in it. I prefer the schools that are alternatives. And those schools, various places, are different names to them. But the point is that those schools have the option of smaller classrooms with teachers not bound by as much curriculum standards and unionized issues, and have true more freedom of choice. Yeah, you know, and if you can attend those schools in the area you're at or get your children into them, then that would be my suggestion. College campuses, unfortunately, are dominated, especially in undergraduate grades, by small, we'll say, thinking, but large groups of people, and it's an unfortunate problem. Because what usually ends up happening is the system becomes more and more group-centered and more away from individuality. It tends more towards socialism and communism by nature in teaching various methods of economies and political things, because it functions that way. And when things function a certain way, their thoughts and truth about everything else become colored. And so you end up with that being the model that is most often taught on a college campus with these large classes. You could say, well, what about the graduate programs where they get down to 20 or even 15 or 10 people? Yeah, that's true. There's more individuality and more individual expression of thought in some of those kinds of classes. I've attended some of those for sure. But unfortunately, the formative aspects of undergraduate colleges, it's overbearing, and it doesn't normally get erased because people go on higher education beyond that. So it's a real problem, and I don't know exactly how we deal with it, because there's an economic issue here and other factors that get into play. And so people say, well, it's just we can't afford it. Well, can we afford to rob the thinking nature of our young people and get them to question things a little more? That's really important, I think it is. Wait, let me give you a little breather here. Give you some time to think about what I just said. And then I want to make some mention of things. First of all, happen to be anywhere around the Phoenix area, and if you can get to Barnes and Noble, which is at the Tempe Marketplace, it's over on McClinock. It's not too far from where I'm speaking to you right now, actually. I know this is coming out of a station in California, but I'm really in that area. I'm in the Phoenix area. Anyway, if you can get to Barnes & Noble on Monday, February 20th, you can hear me speaking in person, yes. I'm going to be talking there from 7 to, give it or take, about 8:15, 8:30, something like that. If you need more information, you can call 480-966-3132 or 800-777-7850. That's 800-777-7850 or 480-966-3132. And I'm going to be talking in general about what people have as concerns about their life, their spiritual life, and what's going on in the world around them today. So I'm going to be talking about just about anything they want to talk about. Yeah, but there will be a number of metaphysical and, we'll say, topics of daily concern that people may have about their lives. So Barnes & Noble, it's an event there, and it'll be this coming Monday, February 20th. That's when I'll be there, 7 p.m. to 8:15, 8:30 p.m. Okay, so we'd love for you to come by. You can visit if you can come. I mean, if you're going to be around there and you can come, I'd love to see you there. Okay, and if, in case you haven't tried it, you should try Phi Chi Jizik because it's on sale. There's nothing else. And if it doesn't work for you, you get your money back. If it does work, what it's going to do is help relieve most of the pain that you have in various different ways. It works on a lot of different kinds of pain, not everything. And it does so in most people, but not everybody. If you don't smoke and you don't use indiscriminately any kind of drugs, then you're a good candidate for a chance. Otherwise, it's a hit or miss if that isn't the truth about your lifestyle. You want to get some? 602-431-5762. You can go on the internet and go to www.byjizik.com and you can get it there. So you have a choice. Try it. Phi Chi Jizik. What is it on sale for? $30 for a large bottle, $12 for a small bottle, and that's considerably less than it was. It was $50 and $20. Whoa. So that's a big smoking deal right there for either size. The small bottle is really a travel kind of size bottle. But the big bottle, it lasts you a while, and it's a great deal. Give it a try and see if it works for the things that are painful, physically painful for you in your life. Okay, so getting back to BBS Radio and the individual and group nature of human souls. Let's talk more about this, because interestingly, evil itself really comes from this point. This is the reason we don't have evil in animals, except the animals come in contact with human beings that we inculcate into their nature, okay? So individualness and groupness is not a component together in most animals. And even if it's there, it's the slightest extent compared to a human being. And because it isn't, animals aren't evil. Evil comes because the human being needs to balance its individual nature and its personality with its group nature and its, we'll say, together with its soul, do this. When it doesn't do this, it can do something very terrible. And I want to talk about this terribleness. It can turn the individual nature into a means of power and control over others. And it can turn the group nature into a means to propaganda and other methods, more mental, of convincing people that they should allow the evil ones, the dark ones, to control them. Well, just the individual nature alone, without too much of the group nature, can lead to evil from the past. That kind of evil was mostly people riding in on horses or with bows and arrows and swords and killing people and chopping them up and forcing them to do what they want them to do, and mostly by fear and terror, emotional-wise, frightening them. Do as I say or you're dead, or tortured, or both. But the group nature can be turned into an even greater evil. This is more recent, and it's only in the last 100 or 200 years that it's really been used very much. And that is to convince people that evil is good by getting them in groups to accept philosophies and economies and religions and you name it, that gives power and control to a very few evil people over those who are fearful on a group level and who will follow the groups that, because of the fears, sometimes also because of carrots or rewards to the group, so that those in power can exercise more and more of the destructive element over life itself. This problem on Earth right now is a biggie. It's so big, actually, that it may be the main reason, probably is the main reason, why there is so much evil in the world. Evil, when it's just based upon the individual side of human beings, cannot grow very fast. But when it gets to convincing others of the group nature, their group nature with others, and that they should follow their group into hell itself by these criminals that want to control others and who manage to, then the results can be truly disastrous. You can do it through any means and any form. You can do it through religion. You can do it through a government, you can do it through an economy, you can do it through an educational system, you can do it through a military system, you can do it through various laws, and you can do it through economics and businesses and structures in business that force people to only have a certain way of exchanging goods and services. All of this can be done through this darkening of the nature of humans. And by splitting apart or removing the soul from the human. Once you split away the soul and you have the individual group nature of the human, but not of the soul included, you then use these two in tandem to convince people that up is down and down is up and good and bad are reversible, and before long, a kind of relativistic evil takes over in almost every form of life, almost every avenue that people can express themselves. If you want to read something that explains this in kind of a story, read Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. It's a pretty long book. If you don't want to read the whole book, you can, the first third of the book you can see in a movie that you made last year, and then pick up the book and read parts 2 and 3. But regardless, it really shows how the group nature, when exaggerated and forced on to others collectively, and when the individual nature of very, very few people is used to destroy others, and destroy society, destroy everything, then evil dominates the whole situation and darkness takes over. Without giving away the whole story, in order to prove that this was really happening to people, it took a few people who saw the problem to remove all of the creative people that were helping the problem to exist so that the system would fail and others would realize how evil it really was. So they kind of accelerated the inevitable. But it's a very interesting book because it shows the darkness of communism. Ayn Rand, she grew up in the Soviet Union and witnessed its inception and its development and was able to express it so well in her philosophy and in her writings, in her novels. So she did a really good thing. Her philosophy she called objectivism, and objectivism is really just trying to get people to face the truth of what it is they are doing and what others are doing to them. But not so easily done when you have such a group conscious, dark group consciousness that has descended on a whole world. In her version of the world, it becomes a worldwide consciousness. Communistic consciousness. And most people say, well, it's just socialism, isn't it? It's socialism too, but it's the socialism and communism of the Soviet Union from the days when she was living there before she came to the United States. Okay. So, this is our fundamental problem with evil in this world, is that we have this dual nature. And evil says, I can use that. I can use that dual nature to really get all these people to follow my evil. See, it's hard for evil to get strong enough and big enough to just affect us emotionally. There's so many people on Earth today, there's 7 billion or so people on Earth. For evil to control all those people by just emotionally through fear is an impossibility. It has to do it through propaganda. It has to convince us that it's right, that we should give up our individual nature and all become little group zombies. You know, let's all have the same exact everything. Same health insurance, the same same kind of religion. You can have different religions, but they're all going to obey the rules of the government. And the same kind of thinking in general. We're all going to eat the same lunches when we go to school. We're all going to follow all these interesting guidelines that are no longer guidelines, but they're laws about how we're going to live. Because we have to be healthy, because we all have the same health insurance. And therefore, there's a group of elite people who have been doing this for about 50 years, but now they're going to run our lives. They've been doing it with suggestions for 50 years. But they literally, next year, take over. Wow. You better look into that if you really want Obamacare. Okay, so the thing here is that you've got to convince people that the group nature is more important than they are. That's evil. Because to the soul, the group nature is to only foster and help develop the individual and the freedom of each individual. The soul never creates anything in group consciousness that is against the nature of God, that each of us is a free being. It just doesn't. And so this is the conflict. And when people say, well, wait a second, if everybody has an individual nature, then why can't they all break laws and not work together or choose to do whatever they want? Well, we can break laws, but if the laws cause harm to others, then we say it's a criminal action and we stop people from doing it. Criminal means that you're using your individual nature to prevent people from being able to function in group consciousness. You can't do that either. If you say, my individual nature is going to stop this or that group from functioning, you stand up in the middle of a mass and you start screaming and yelling, I don't want you to talk about God here. I don't like that. And then people in the mass say, well, you know what? You can go outside and say that, but you can't say it here. Because this is our group meeting with God, and we want to have our conversation with God. And so that's the point. The individual, though, is upheld and in highest esteem and given the full value of what it means to God to be a creative being and a co-creator with it that only can come from individuality. And so the group nature of souls is to support that. But the group nature of evil is to destroy that. Okay? Now, I'm trying to make this as clear as I can make it, but a lot of people may not, because of various political beliefs or other things, have an easy time listening to me. That's okay. I don't mind that. I understand. Here is the issue. How do you know which side is right at any time? Because I just gave you two examples that could be in conflict with each other. The answer is this. It's the balance of the two that provides us with the ability to determine what the truth is. You know truth because when there is truth, no one is being harmed. No one is being destroyed in their life. They may be restricted in some way. They may give up something. But they are not destroyed. They aren't harmed to the point where the nature of who they are has to change. The very beingness of what they are has to change in order to become in accord with evil. This is a big deal. Now, I'm giving you some suggestions on how to figure this out. Even the suggestions are going to have exceptions to them. So you have to always be thinking, always be concerned about finding truth. And truth doesn't last. The truth of today will not be the truth of tomorrow because new facts become known. New information enters the system. And then you've got to possibly make a different kind of decision. The individual group nature of souls is what we want to be. When we turn our back on our soul, we become open to evil and the possession by it. We become taunted and sometimes confused to find truth. And we become cajoled and even we'll say bought off to go along with the dark side. When that happens, it isn't just giving up the truth that's the problem. It's giving up our soul. Separation of the human being from their soul is the greatest danger that evil presents to humanity, and it happens the greatest amount of the time here in the physical world. When it takes place, great sadness in all souls exists. And little can be done to save those people who it happens to, because they do not seek, nor will they cooperate with goodness. So it is a real problem. The individual and group nature is the very cross that human beings are. And we cannot give up either. We must balance them and become like our soul to succeed here as a co-creator with God. Now, this subject may have many other ramifications, some of which I'm not going to go into night. But I'm sure you, as you think about this in terms of your own life, you will be able to come up with many, many parts of your life where this has been an issue and you didn't realize. You thought it was something else. Most of the time, when people are confronted with these issues, they think it's something else. Why? Because it really frightens us to realize that it's about us and our soul than some other kind of thing. Well, it's just about whether I pay my taxes or whether I do this or that. No, it's something else entirely. But we don't want to recognize the true nature and importance of the issues that we deal with on a daily basis. How do we get to past the dark side? I mean, it's everywhere around us. It's almost so much around us that we don't really see it anymore. It's like almost everything. How do we get past it? Well, one of the ways to ensure that you don't become inculcated with this disease we're called is that you examine both sides in yourself of every issue as an individual and a group nature subject. And you make sure that you find truth, even if it's not a perfect level of truth, as good as you can find at that time for yourself. Remember, the truth always has to include all the information that you have. One of the problems, and one of the ways that evil tries to win us over, is by excluding significant amounts of information, and then relying upon some bits and pieces of information, which oftentimes may be contradictory, but they ignore the things that make them look contradictory, and try to convince us that this very narrow range of information is all that is available and all that we need to know. Anytime someone is trying to do that with you, they're conning you, and they're on the dark side. Don't let yourself be done that way, and don't do it to yourself. And for sure, don't do it to others. You want to make sure that people can have the maximum amount of information, including yourself, so that you can bring that to a, we'll say, synthesized, highest form of knowledge that then you can use to be conscious with. You can see where that knowledge does and doesn't apply. And you'll find it. So, another thing that I want to bring into this discussion is the reduction of awareness. What reduces awareness? Substances. Drugs, alcohol, another kind of drug, right? And that's how it leads to the dark side. The dark side doesn't want us to have information other than what it wants to feed us, right? Well, the simplest way to do that is to ruin our senses, by making sure that we use drugs. The drugs cut down the senses, limit them to a certain minimal level, and then the information is piped in from the dark side that it wants us to hear and know, sense, and use. So then it's in control of our knowledge. Didn't know that, did you? So why is it so important not to use substances and abuse them? Because the dark side is waiting. What other sorts of things will cut down your awareness? Lack of sleep? Choosing to continually operate where the senses are diminished because of excessive overload of only one kind of sense. That can even be literally going to the same kind of informational whatever you're going to, be it a school or whatever, continuously, hearing and learning and seeing and experiencing only one thing, or only one set of things. It literally wears out your senses, Plus, it inculcates, it completely overwhelms you with only one kind of information. And that's an easy way to then become darkened. We do this with children. We send them to schools where they only hear one kind of information. They may go on to colleges where it gets even worse. And so this is a way of indoctrinating people. It's a way of the dark side controlling us. And so they revel in getting that. They revel in it. It's perfect. Don't put yourself in that position. Don't put your children in that position. Fight against it in every way possible. Fight against your school system being that way. And many are. Free thinking. That's what you want to have, is free thinking. How important is it? Huge. Big deal. Incredibly important. Okay, what else can we do for ourselves that will improve the situation? We need to have variance in our levels of awareness. We need to have new and different input from all kinds of sources. Is it okay to learn about evil? Sure. Evil hates to be exposed, and when it is exposed, it wants you to think that it's everywhere when it's not, so that you overreact to things that aren't evil and restrict them. Evil has its ways, but you can beat it in those situations. How else can you do this? Well, if you focus on the good, if you're seeking to be virtuous, to create more light in the form around you, in everything you're doing, you become almost impervious to the onslaught of evil, no matter how bad it is. Even if your senses are overwhelmed by some things at some time, and you haven't slept too much in recent times, you can still fight it off if you're focused on creating the good. I suggest you do that, both individually and in group. People talk about, well, aren't spiritual groups the way to do everything? Well, they are if they're spiritual, and that's what they need to be doing, is spiritual stuff, but the individuals still do individual things. And they still have to be virtuous in the ways that they do those individual things. And they can't rely upon the fact that they're in a spiritual group to do that. They have to be individually virtuous. Too many people think otherwise. Oh, well, I went to a meditation meeting and I did this and that. Now I can go do my individual things of being a son of a gun. No. That doesn't work. I don't care what group you claim to be part of. That won't do anything for you. It's in contradiction. You have to be who you are all the time. A soul. Yeah, or as much as you can. All right, let's talk about realistic factors here for a second. Most people cannot be their soul much more than 25% of the time. And that's the ones that are really doing a pretty good job of it. I'm not talking about the very, very, very few who might be up to 50 or 60% or more. Those are rare birds. Let's talk about the rest of the world, okay? 25% is probably a good thing. And if you are 25%, you're not going to become evil. When are you in danger of becoming evil? When your consciousness probably drops below 5% and you're faced with very serious problems. Or if your consciousness drops below 1 or 2% and you're faced with just normal life problems. But in either case, it's a relative thing. The more conscious you are, the more you're giving, and the more you are attempting to create light in the world, the less chance that you're going to be disconnected from your soul, the less chance you're going to be affected by darkness or evil, and the better person you're going to be. Why do you want to be a better person anyway? Well, because that's where God is. And you know, no matter what you believe, if you go against God, somewhere down the line, it may take a while because you're separating cause from effect when you're doing that. So it may take a long time to catch up. But when it does catch up, you're in for one heck of a bad kick in the butt. Really. because there's no punitive issue here. It's all about the separation of time and space and the results of karmic implications. You're going to have a lot of seriously bad things happen. And they're going to be terrible things in relationship to how you've lived your life. So ultimately, you want to be with God, because God is the place where joy and bliss exist. God is the place where ultimately you get to be all the wonderful things you want to be. And you don't suffer. That's the good part about it. Now, if you're going to belabor the fact that, yeah, if I'm with God, according to what I read in your book, that's going to accelerate my karma in the beginning. Yeah, all right. Can you handle that? Can you handle a few weeks or months of accelerated karma? Possibly. It's possibly true. Maybe you can. But, you know, that's nothing compared to the other side of the fence. Is it possible for someone to truly live a life where they have joined together their individuality and their group nature in harmony? Souls do it all the time, but is it possible for people to do that? And the answer is yes. The answer is, on an average, we could do it about 20-25% of the time without being part necessarily of a spiritual group, but we could just live our life that way. When you want to exceed that level, then it's going to be very difficult, because you need others more closely associated with you to pull off the group side of it. You could always be an individual and create light, but to do so efficiently and effectively in today's world, you need a group once you reach a certain level, and that's in the ballpark around that. Then the only thing you can do in those situations is you can hope and pray that you will find a group of people that will work with you in that respect. But you can also put out your feelers and let people know what you want to do. Remember, this doesn't need to mean that you've got to give up your individuality. It's just the opposite. You've got to keep your individuality and use it to serve humanity. Use it to be a co-creator with God. It doesn't mean that you are going to be living on the street with nothing. Some people believe that, or live in a cave somewhere. I mean, it's all nonsense. Anyone who's doing that, how could they be serving people? They're living a subsistence life. They're barely able to exist. It would make absolutely no sense. Can you earn money? Absolutely. Money is part of time. It's just compressed time and energy. You need lots of money to do things. So, of course. I mean, it's all pragmatic issues. It's pragmatic senses. But you do want to be in a free market system. You do want to be in a capitalistic system. You want to be in a system where there's freedom of just about every avenue of expression, as long as it creates more light in the world. That's what you want. And you want to do your very best to create it and fight everything that's preventing it from being happening. Because if it's out there and preventing you, it's preventing others, and so you want to stop it. You want to do what you can to prevent it. And that's part of the nature of things. Eventually, when we face our overall life here in the physical world, it's quite short. We have a very short time to learn how to live, both as an individual and group, in nature and as a soul. Learning to live as a soul in the physical world is the hardest thing we can possibly do. And if we can do it in our level of response, we have a very successful life here. Now, why do we eventually die then? And we die because the nature of us here can only reach a certain level. It can never reach the level, never, that a freed soul has. It can barely reach the level that our soul as it is in the mental world exists in. And that's a tremendous amount in comparison to what most people get to. At the end of our life here, we face bringing together our individual and group natures in much closer harmony with others at the same time, without the restrictions of the physical world being so severe, and without as much evil as there is here and now in this world. So we reach that point. I know this is hard to understand. And with the help of our soul decides that, you know what, this is as far as we can go in creating light. And then we call it quits. Lots of ways to call it quits, but they all involve one word, death. And the death is the death not of our consciousness, which goes on and expands somewhat, but the death of the physical body and senses that have worn themselves thin and down, that don't work as well as they did in an earlier age, and that are not even upholding our physical body's life very much anymore. The limitations set upon us at that point exceed the need to create more light, and so we choose to leave. Now, we being our soul and us, most of the time more the soul than us, with us sometimes kicking and screaming in fear because we have ignorance. From here we move on to the astral world. Now, in the astral world, the separation between individual and group nature is less. Instantly. Now, why is that the case? Because the physics change. That's the good news. Evil is confined to a very narrow region of the astral world. As long as you don't live in those areas, it's not going to have much to do with you. That's good news. And you have a greater opportunity to experience yourself as a soul in its true nature. Your individuality becomes more expressive. And your group nature, because of the physics, allows you to express your group nature by having better and more communication with others almost instantly in ways that we can't even accomplish here with all the technology we have today. We're trying to simulate it to some extent to some things we're doing here, but they're not very successful. In the astral world, it's almost like second nature. We can do all this stuff. If you need to communicate with somebody at a great distance, you can. If you need to be someplace that is a great distance, you can travel there almost instantaneously. And you can understand others much better because your senses work in so many different and better ways, and because others and you seek to be more part of God, partly because you're not as afraid of death since you've died and are still alive there. And also, they seek that with you, so ultimately, group consciousness is easier to grow there. But it's also easier to create things, anything, with just your creative imagination. And so consequently, the individual nature of a person is expanded at the same time, if you choose it. And this is the wondrous, we'll say, grace that you get after living such a difficult life while physically alive. So your individual nature is joining with your group nature as soon as you get to the astral world, provided you're away from it. Now, if you're in the sixth or seventh subworlds or in the eighth sphere, evil can get you. If you're in the eighth sphere, you are evil. And if you're in the seventh or sixth subworlds, evil can reach you. So those are difficult places. But most people actually don't go there for those places. They go to the fifth or higher subworld, and they don't experience evil. Instead, they may worry about it to some extent someday affecting them, but they live pretty much in an evil-free environment. They may exaggerate elements that they believe are either too much group or too little individual, too much individual in some circumstances, especially on the fifth subworld, this is true. Not so much so in the fourth. So the ultimate goal for people once they have died is to join these two natures of themselves into greater harmony. No matter where they live, that can be true, but it's mostly true for people who live in the fifth subworld and higher. And it is a real relief for people who, when they get over there after they die, to find this stress that is so common to physical life to be missing. The inner stress of the conflict of their individual and group nature. It kind of is ameliorated by the physics of the astral dimension. It makes life far less anxious. And more, we'll say, for most people in the astral world, they have a sense that they're in a heavenly-like world. And they realize it's not, quote-unquote, heaven by the definitions of the religion they're in. But at least it has a promise of reducing this tremendous stress that ends life so quickly in the physical world. Consequently, people live for very long times, in relative time, in the astral world, without wearing themselves out, at least as much, because they're not under the same level of stress. Here in the physical world, the stress, again, starts from the individual nature versus the group nature of human beings. And with us being at cross purposes with this on a daily basis, creating the stresses that we have. Family. The issues of family. I didn't bring this up. I should have. Let's see this time I got. Families produce a great deal of this pressure. As soon as you get married, you have a spouse. Right? That spouse starts the beginning of most people's individual or group nature stresses. But you had it when you were a child and you lived in a family, if you did, under the same circumstances. Except now, as an adult, it becomes you, the actor, rather than the receiver of the stresses in the family. Families are a big stressor. And why do people have families? Because they're trying to find themselves as souls. Families are important. Families provide the personality with its first, we'll say, laboratory to experimentally function how it can join these two natures together and work them as one. That's why we have so many conflicts in families, is because of the individual group nature of us. Do animals have this problem? Well, primates do to some extent, but not nearly as bad as human beings. But a lot of other animals do not have the same levels. No. They have some stresses through being in a pack or a herd, but those stresses are nothing compared to what human beings create in their family. Sorry, I forgot about that because I wanted to include that in there. Well, anyway, let me segue that back into the astral world. In the astral world, family takes on a different meaning because the people there have a closer connection between these two sides of themselves. They're acting a bit more like souls. And so families are not the stressors that they can be in the physical world. That doesn't mean they don't have stress. But people can usually work through those stresses more easily, making their whole life a bit easier to handle in the astral world. Now, what other elements then come into play if people do live much longer, they can live hundreds of relative years longer in the astral world, and they don't wear out as fast, their senses usually last longer. So they do better in that respect. Do they ever get to become fully operational souls? They could, but they have to be functioning from a very high subworld, like usually the first subworld, to be in that category. And even then, they can't operate as much like a soul as they would if they were in the monastic world, which they're going to be next. It's truly in the monastic or mental side of life that people are able to finally join together these two natures into one and act more like a soul. Why is that? What's in the astral world that's so different from mental? And that's feelings. The aspect of feeling and the sense of feeling still is overbearing to the mental capacity and mental thought. And as long as it takes precedence over mental thinking, one's feelings will separate the individual group nature of people into competing sides instead of working in unison and being a part of God. Then how come we have that? Well, because God wants a part of the universe to be about feelings. Feelings are a type of energy that we have to master. And human beings have to live in their feelings, both physically and astrally in our life, but much more intensely while they're astral life than while they're physical life. And it's these intense feelings that they have that they have to be able to change into pure love in every situation, which is not so easy to do. It is that conflict of turning those feelings into pure love that sometimes results in the separation between the individual and group nature of people, and then they're not acting as a soul. The astral world is a good place for this to work itself out because the feelings are so intense and the physical feelings aren't dominating them anymore because you don't have any physical feelings, there's no physical energy. And so people do have the opportunity to really master this, but they don't normally in one lifetime, but they still can do better. And the feelings are obviously dominant in comparison here, in comparison to the physical world. So you can't just overlook them, as some people choose to for a while here, and develop emotional illnesses because of it. But the point is that once a person realizes that they need to balance their individual group nature, which may not happen right away in the astral world, but once they realize that that's what they need to do, their ability to do it is considerably better than while they were physically alive. And their chances of achieving it many times more likely to happen in the astral world than while they're in the physical world. So it's something to look forward to. I don't want us all to jump off the roof at something and kill ourselves. I'm just suggesting that the fear of death should not be such a terrible thing because we're moving towards greater opportunities at living as souls without the conflicts that we live with here in the physical world facing us, as they do almost every day. Those conflicts are terrifying and difficult. So going on to the astral world should not be considered like some kind of terrible thing. It's a definite improvement in most people's lives. Not like, oh, well, gee, I got to go to the astral world. It's a terrible thing. The only thing you're going to miss is the stress of life. Some physical sensations that people do like occasionally have, they won't be available. But generally speaking, overall life improves tremendously, and we can look forward to this better place where we'll be more like ourselves. Finally, the individual and group nature becomes second nature when we get to the monastic world and we get over our egotism and arrogance. And then we can function with others together. This is before we join our soul again. As mental denizens, mental world denizens, we can experience what it's like to function more soul-like, like over half the time now, not the 25% for people who are spiritually disciplining themselves in this world, but you're functioning more than half the time as a soul. And your life really becomes an amazing experience because you're about to become a soul, you know that. You're going back to that state, and in the meantime, you're living as a human being in the last part of human life, finding truth in almost everything you think about, not contaminated any longer by strong feelings that feel so much different than what we know to be truth, and no longer conflicted about your nature of being an individual or part of group consciousness. You're both, and you don't have any problem with it. That's a real great, wonderful place to be, a place that all of us would love to have happen to us while we're physically alive. I don't want you to lose sight of the fact that you can improve it here. But even if you fail to improve it here, you will most likely have things better after this. So there's lots to look forward to. Let's still work together to try to make it as good as we can while we can here. And work together to be both creative, like our co-creator, God, together, here, individuals, at the same time be group conscious and work with others to support the individuality of others while we group together and group consciously co-create with God at the same time. Well, I hopefully this has all made sense to you tonight, and this has brought this together in some practical way. Until next week, of course, until Monday, if you're coming to see me this coming Monday at Barnes & Noble. But in either case, this is Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.